Everyone, please continue eating. My name is Jim Dunlap, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies and its Criminal Law Practice Group and its Chicago Lawyers Chapter. The Chicago Chapter is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, which makes it only 4 years younger than the Federalist Society itself. And there are a couple of upcoming events I'll just mention while you're finishing your lunch and before we get started. On April 21st, we're going to hold another one of our tavern debates. These are informal gatherings at a tavern where a proposition, somewhat incendiary in nature, is debated. The proposition for this one is that, resolved, the battle of the sexes is over, women have won. Not on that committee. The last one was actually very interesting. It was resolved that America's best days are behind it, and it was defeated in a narrow vote in a division that was 21-17. So it sort of shows you where opinion is on the state of our country right now. They're fun events. I encourage you to come out. On April 28th, a more serious event we'll be co-sponsoring with the American Constitution Society, which is our friendly foil across the aisle on many of these issues. The event will mark the 100th anniversary of the Haymarket riots and will focus on labor management relations in the modern age. I'm sure there will be a nod to public employee labor management relations as well, given what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and elsewhere. There will be events for the summer associates in the city in July, and then marking the 10th anniversary of 9/11, a very sad anniversary, we will have a formal Oxford-style debate between John Yoo, formerly of the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, I'm sure you know of him, famous for having written the so-called torture memos, and he's now a professor at Bolt Hall Law School at Berkeley, and Alberto Cole, a professor of international law at DePaul University Law School here in Chicago. That debate will be on the extent of presidential powers in wartime. Today we're pleased to have a distinguished panel and a distinguished moderator to discuss changes in honest services law since the Supreme Court decided those cases last year, two cases involving private individuals and one involving a public servant. Honest services fraud has been the prosecutor's best friend for many years in Chicago, and it's not saying too much to say that the doctrine really originated here with prosecutions in the 1970s of Governor Kerner and others. And I know several veteran prosecutors who still refer to it as George mail fraud after U.S. versus George, one of the seminal early cases. Our moderator today is Gil Sofer. Gil is co-chairman of the white collar practice at Katten Muchin Rosenman, which is a global law firm. And he joined the firm in August 2006 after 6 years as a federal prosecutor. He concentrates his practice in white collar criminal litigation, particularly corporate fraud litigation, and corporate investigations. In January of 2008, Gil accepted a position as counsel to the Deputy Attorney General, who was then Mark Philip in Washington, D.C., and shortly thereafter was appointed Associate Deputy Attorney General. During his year-long term with the Department of Justice, Gil advised the Deputy Attorney General on criminal matters at the department with particular emphasis on corporate fraud prosecutions. He played an integral role in drafting the department's corporate monitor principles and corporate charging principles and provided training on the latter to U.S. attorney's offices nationwide. He also managed the president's corporate fraud task force and briefed Congress about criminal matters with the Department of Justice. Gil graduated magna cum laude from Brown University. He also attended the Harvard Law School and clerked here in the Northern District for Judge Nordberg. In December of last year, 2009, Mr. Sofer was appointed by Governor Quinn here in Illinois to serve as a commissioner on the Illinois Executive Ethics Commission. That commission was formed to promote ethics in the executive branch of public service and to ensure that state business is conducted with fairness and integrity. So I present to you our moderator for the day, Gil Sofer, who will introduce our distinguished panel. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim. Good afternoon, everybody. Well, it is a privilege to be here today, and especially a privilege because we're really talking about one of the hottest topics in criminal law, and that is the so-called honest services fraud doctrine or honest services statute. So what is honest services? I'm not going to steal anybody's thunder, but at the risk of oversimplification, it is a statute that makes it a federal crime to deprive someone of their right to another's honest services. On that point, I think it's safe to say there's general agreement. There ought to be. That's more or less the language of the statute. And there's also general agreement, for example, that it would be a crime under that statute for, say, a senator to take a bribe in exchange for passing a piece of legislation. But that's about where the consensus ends, because for years there has been mounting criticism that the statute is unconstitutionally vague, that beyond the obvious case of the senator on the take, it gives too little notice about what kind of conduct or misconduct is criminal, and that the government has simply pressed this statute too far. And Jim's absolutely right. If there's one district where the action has been on this statute, it's the one we're sitting in right now. Now, last year, the Supreme Court jumped into the fray with a series of decisions, three decisions, that, quite frankly, I think, raise almost as many questions as they answer. But happily, we have three genuine experts on this subject who will enlighten us today about this very controversial and very important subject in criminal law. So let me now introduce them to you, and I have the pleasure of knowing all of them. First is John Elwood. John is a partner in the appellate practice group at Vinson and Elkins in D.C., and he specializes in federal criminal law and federal regulation. Before joining V&E, he served in a number of positions in the Justice Department as senior deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the think tank of the Department of Justice, as an assistant to the Solicitor General, as counselor to Assistant Attorney General Mike Chertoff, and as an attorney in the Criminal Division's appellate section. John also served as the department's commissioner on the U.S. Sentencing Commission back in the days when the guidelines were mandatory, and he served on the Criminal Rules Advisory Committee. John also authored the government's briefs in district court defending the search of the Capitol Hill offices of Representative William Jefferson. While he's been in private practice, John has represented the third consecutive Louisiana insurance commissioner to be convicted of a federal felony while in office. It's hard to make Illinois look good. And it's worth noting he was acquitted on most of those counts. And also of particular relevance to us today, John prepared Jeff Skilling's lawyer for the Supreme Court argument in his case, and of course that case touches very much on honest services. John served as a law clerk to Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court and to Judge Mahoney on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. John is a graduate of Princeton University and Yale Law School, and we're very happy to have him with us today, and he flew out from D.C., and we're grateful for it. Ron Safer is another of our guest speakers, and he is the managing partner of Schiff Hardin in Chicago, where he concentrates his practice in white-collar criminal defense and civil litigation. I first met Ron at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the 1990s, and I can tell you he's had a truly remarkable career and a truly remarkable career in that office. He oversaw all financial fraud cases at the office, and he supervised all 100 assistant U.S. attorneys in the criminal division there. He did successfully prosecute hundreds of defendants, including practically the entire leadership of the Gangster Disciples street gang. Since rejoining Schiff Hardin in 1999, Ron has led the defense on equally high-profile cases. Among them was the trial of Mark Kipnis, who was one of the co-defendants and a lawyer in the Conrad Black case. Now, Ron and his legal team obtained not guilty verdicts on the most serious counts against Mr. Kipnis and ultimately secured a sentence of probation, which was quite a bit shy of the more than 10 years that the government was requesting in that case. Again, Ron's work on that case is particularly relevant to us today because that case ultimately turned into one of those three Supreme Court cases that has changed the face of honest services law. Ron has earned a long list of honors and distinctions for his work both in and out of government. He is a graduate of University of Pennsylvania and Georgetown Law School, and we are fortunate to have him with us. And finally, Brian Murray is a partner at Jones Day in Chicago, where he leads the issues and appeals practice. He's an experienced appellate litigator with more than a dozen appeals under his belt in federal and state courts across the country. He handles complex commercial, class action, and multi-jurisdictional litigation. Now, Brian's had too many victories for me to count out here today, but there's one that deserves special mention, and that is a U.S. Supreme Court victory in one of the three landmark cases about honest services fraud. So we're very lucky to have his insider's view of that case, just as we are the insider view of his co-panelists. Brian serves as a lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School, where he teaches complex litigation, and he's on the national board of the American Inns of Court Foundation, among other distinguished positions. Brian also lectures and publishes widely on a broad range of legal issues. He served as a law clerk on the Supreme Court to Justice Scalia and to Judge O'Scanlan on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He's a graduate of Notre Dame, where he attended both college and law school. So welcome to all of our participants. The format today is very simple. We will invite them all to come up, and each will spend about 10, 15 minutes addressing the issues today, and then we'll open the floor for questions. So with that, I think we should begin, and I invite our panelists to come on up. And I think, Brian, you'll lead the charge.
So again, welcome everybody. I have the strange distinction of being the only guy on the panel who actually doesn't do white-collar prosecution stuff on a daily basis. I'm just a humble appellate lawyer. So this is sort of a busman's holiday for me. I did have the good fortune of working on Weyrauch, which is one of the three honest services cases the Supreme Court handed down a couple years ago together. And so what we thought we would do is, for while a lot of people in the room might be honest services experts, I know at least a couple here aren't, so I thought what we might do to start is to talk a little bit about honest services, the background, how we got to the blockbuster three cases, what the court did, and how we ended up where we are here in 2011. And then my co-panelists, who have their finger on the pulse, can tell you what this means and where we're going and what the implications are. Really, the current hot-button issues in honest services all crystallized in a case called Sorich, which came right here out of our own Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, dealing with political patronage hiring over at City Hall. Really, what the court was dealing with there was this honest services fraud statute. So project back. There are federal crimes like mail fraud and wire fraud, which require that someone be deprived of property to commit the crime. Over the course of years, long, long ago, courts had come up with a doctrine that said, well, property doesn't always mean property. If, for instance, you're an elected official and you do something bad, you take a bribe, even though you're not depriving your constituents of anything at all, you're depriving them of your honest services. And so that can qualify for property that will get you prosecuted under some of these fraud statutes. In McNally, which is a 1987 Supreme Court case, the court weighed in and said no. In fact, the statute doesn't say that. It says deprive of property, whether it's mail fraud or wire fraud. So we can't be having this honest services approach to these kinds of fraud crimes. If Congress wants to do that, it must speak more clearly than it has. Congress spoke, and quickly. On a rider to a bill sort of jammed in at the dead of night, Congress added the following 28 words. You can't make this up. They said, for the purposes of this chapter, the term scheme or artifice to defraud includes a scheme or artifice to defraud another of the intangible right of honest services. Okay, thanks, Congress. No more guidance than that as to what that means. There was a very helpful piece of legislative history put in after the bill was passed by Senator Biden. Usually you think of legislative history being what the history of the legislation was rather than something jammed in afterwards, but anyway, there you are. So courts took this as a mandate to apply these kinds of fraud to a broad swath of activities, unclear though it was. So cases came out of the courts of appeals, such as a businessman paying a legislator for some behind-the-scenes influence, or students scheming with their professor to turn in plagiarized work, or lawyers paying insurance adjusters just to move the cases along, not on the merits, or city employees in political patronage hiring right here in Chicago. Justice Scalia dissented from the denial of certiorari in Sorich. The court declined to take the case and made the point that if the theory really is as broad as courts have embraced it to be, there's really no logical stopping point. It could cover a legislator's decision to vote a certain way to curry favor with minority interests that aren't, you know, to the benefit of the majority of his constituents. It could qualify as the mayor using his name to get a prestigious table at a local restaurant. It could even qualify, and this should strike fear into the hearts of any of you into the private sector, as for a salaried employee who calls in sick and then actually goes to a ball game. He would have, at that point, deprived his employer of the right to his honest services and is a federal felon. Now, if you're a Cubs fan, this may not be an issue. They've had some trouble the last couple of years. But for you Sox fans, you might want to go. You can see why that's a problem. In any event, the courts of appeals, understanding some of these problems, had tried to put curbs on the breadth of this really difficult to understand statute.
The Fifth Circuit had weighed in and sort of made this up as judicial doctrine and said, well, although it says honest services and sort of broadly, really what it means is someone has to have done something wrong that violates state law, and that gives a hook that makes their conduct criminal and prosecutable under this federal felony statute. The Seventh Circuit took a slightly different approach and said, well, you know, at a minimum, that person has to have some private gain. If what he does doesn't get him anything for himself, even if he's depriving everybody of their honest services, that's a limiting principle. There must be private gain. There seemed to be a general sense in the courts of appeals of frustration that this statute was so broad, but no one really knew what to do with it to rein it in. So the problems came together in a trio. After Justice Scalia dissented from denial, the court ultimately took three cases. Justice Scalia had warned, bad men like good men are entitled to be tried and sentenced in accordance with good law, and we should figure out what that is. And so the court tried to take cases to figure this out from all three perspectives. They took a Seventh Circuit case where we had adopted this public gain rule, Conrad Black with the Hollinger bankruptcy. They took Jeff Skilling's case from the Enron debacle in the Fifth Circuit. And they took the case of our client, Bruce Weyrauch, who was an Alaska legislator. Bruce was a lawyer. Alaska, unlike Illinois, doesn't make a full-time business out of its politics. In fact, its state legislators are part-time legislators. They're encouraged to keep jobs and do stuff in the private sector so that they're really focused on being citizens as well as legislators. He was elected in 2002 and represented Juneau in the Alaska House. When in 2006, the governor, Frank Murkowski, had come up with legislation to change the way that Alaska taxed oil production. It was going to be a tax that would tie the state's tax on oil producers to a percentage of their profits. VECO was a big oil company. You can probably guess what their views on this legislation were. Oddly enough, they said, all right, but no more than 20% should be the tax. Bruce had decided in May of 2006 not to run for re-election for his spot in the legislature, so he sent a letter to Bill Allen, president and CEO of VECO, and said, hey, I'm a lawyer. I've done some stuff for you guys in the past. I'd like to do more work for you, and I'm leaving my position as a legislator soon. Maybe we should talk. He placed that letter into the United States mail. No quid pro quo, no I'll help you out on this tax bill, just I'd like to work for you when I leave the legislature. Well, the legislative session ended without a vote on this tax bill, and the governor called the legislators back into a special session to vote on the bill. At that point, the CEO in May sent an email to Bruce and to other members of the legislature saying, here's our position on this, go ahead and vote for it, but only 20%. Bruce emailed Allen back when he got that and said, oh, I sent you this letter before about working for you guys, can we still talk? And so they set up a meeting. After the meeting, Bruce sent a thank you note and said, I look forward to working with you guys in the future. The paper record was now set for the prosecution. Bruce ultimately proposed adjourning the legislature without a vote on the bill. The governor then brought them back and said, no, you will vote on the bill. Bruce told VECO at that point he'd get involved, go to meetings, and inform them. On August, the last day of the session, the bill passed. It imposed the tax, and it did so at 22.5%, which is more than VECO had wanted. More importantly, Bruce voted for it nonetheless. As the government was prosecuting Ted Stevens in connection with that whole thing, they came across some of these letters and some of this correspondence and ultimately charged Bruce Weyrauch with, among other things, honest services fraud, based on the letter and the emails that he had deprived his constituents of the right to his honest services by soliciting employment with this organization while voting on their tax interests. As trial approached, the government, which had taken a quid pro quo theory that he was trading his legislative powers for some sort of a job in the future, realized that, in fact, there was no quid pro quo. There was some talking, it was fuzzy around the edges, but there was never a, I'll vote for this, and in fact, he ended up voting for something that the company didn't want. So they changed their theory from a quid pro quo to a non-disclosure. The government's theory became, you had a conflict of interest and you had to disclose it to Alaskans. This came to a head when cross motions in limine were filed before trial, and Bruce's lawyers argued, and the district court agreed, there was no duty to disclose. It was undisputed there was no duty in Alaska law for Bruce to disclose anything, nor was there any independent duty anywhere else in federal law for him to disclose anything in the way of a conflict of interest here. So the district court granted the motion in limine and said they couldn't try him on that count. The government appealed, and the Ninth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, per Judge, come on, this is a Federalist Society event. What do I have to do around here? All right. The judge, Judge Fisher on the Ninth Circuit said, well, no, actually it's not a problem at all to proceed to trial under this sort of vague theory. It doesn't matter that Alaska law hasn't found any duty to disclose here. The Honest Services Fraud Law established a uniform standard for the honest services that govern every public official, and the government doesn't have to prove an independent violation of state law. As to what the contours are, we the federal judges can figure that out, because that's what the federal statute wants us to do. We the federal judges will figure out what state political officials should be doing, and we'll hold them accountable accordingly. At a minimum, Judge Fisher said for the court, this would involve bribes and non-disclosure of material information. Whatever that means. That's when my firm got involved. We worked with Mr. Weyrauch to petition the court for certiorari, and we became one of the three cases that went up on appeal. We wrote what I will, you know, candidly but also modestly described as just an excellent set of briefs. And we tried to make four key points. The first is you can't really start with the plain text of this statute because it doesn't tell you anything. What you have to do is resort to the usual tools judges do to figure out what to do in a situation like this. First of all, you need a clear statement that the federal government wanted to get involved and to regulate state actors in this way before the federal government ought to be allowed to invade state prerogatives. Second, we made a constitutional avoidance argument, which is if you expand this thing out to its outer limits, you end up with the parade of horribles Justice Scalia had mentioned. That's vagueness. That would make it unconstitutional. You don't want to construe it that way. Third, criminal law, rule of lenity. One should be entitled to know what the law is before one is prosecuted for violating it. We also made the argument that there can't be common law crimes. The Supreme Court gave that up 200 years ago. They shouldn't start over again. We, in our case, didn't have the straight up, this is unconstitutional challenge that Justice Scalia seemed to be advocating for in his Sorich dissent. So we were around the edges. We didn't raise that straight up. One of the other cases, Skilling, actually did raise that. So they granted these three cases altogether. We had arguments. They were consolidated. The panel was all over various of the lawyers, but oddly left our guy, Don Ayer, one of my partners from Washington, argued it. Oddly, they kind of left him alone. They asked him some questions, but they were very mild. We took this as a good sign. Then we got the opinions, and we figured out why. Skilling, which was the lead opinion, written by Justice Ginsburg, badly fractured, but ultimately comes out and says the following. Yes, this statute's a mess, but we can't just throw up our hands. Congress passed this, and we have to construe it in a way that's reasonable if we possibly can. At a minimum, if you look at all the pre-McNally case law, what the courts were holding was that this statute would apply to bribes and kickbacks. So at a minimum, we can ignore the rest of the fog, but that's what this statute means. Sort of a triumph of purposivism over textualism. Going forward, as construed by the Supreme Court, those are the kinds of areas this statute will apply to. So they remanded Skilling's case since his was a conspiracy count for a harmless error analysis. In the other cases, Conrad Black's case also had to go back because his conduct wasn't squarely within either of those two heartlands. There was a question whether he had preserved the objection. They wrote a short opinion to say he had, and they also sent that back for further consideration. And then in our case, we achieved a one-sentence order vacating and remanding in light of Skilling. Interestingly, all of our brilliant arguments about how this shouldn't apply to state actors and state legislators as public officials in the way that they didn't get worked out in the Skilling opinion because he was a private actor, didn't get worked out in the Short Conrad opinion, who was also a private actor. So I'm pretty much free to tell the world that our briefs were excellent because no one will ever know otherwise because the Supreme Court didn't rule on them. So a somewhat unsatisfying result from my personal perspective, I'm pretty sure we were right, but a win is a win. And ultimately our case was remanded as well, and the Ninth Circuit sent it back for trial without that on a services count. What this does in the way they've come down with the cases is leaves open a very obvious disconnect between how we think about honest services from legislators and public officials versus how we think about honest services from employees who might have slightly different considerations. They just didn't address the public prong at all. That is the state of the law from the Supreme Court and where we find ourselves here as we sit here today in 2011. And I'll now pass it off to my panelists to tell you what that means.
Please. When Jim Dunlop, you know, when we started getting this thing organized and he asked me whether I thought the Skilling decision was correct, I thought, yeah, I think so. I think they probably did the right thing by narrowing the statute and not striking it down entirely. Because, you know, I give Congress a very broad presumption of constitutionality. And, you know, everybody knows they wanted to overrule McNally, and this was kind of the core of what McNally, pre-McNally law had said was prohibited. And, you know, so we can kind of discern what Congress wanted to do, so that's fine. And as I've been preparing for this, I've decided I'm going to eat those words, because the more you look at the state of the law now, the more you realize how neither Congress nor the Skilling majority really answered a lot of very basic questions. And at the end of the day, you're left wondering whether or not Congress has spoken, or here's the language, whether they have defined the offense with sufficient definiteness that ordinary people can understand what conduct is prohibited, unquote. And I don't know how you can hardly say that that standard is met. I'm going to go through some of the current circuit splits. Let me know if I'm talking too loudly or if the microphone's amplifying me too much. I'm going to talk about some of the splits that are out there now. And I'm an appellate lawyer. I'm someone who looks for circuit splits for a living. And I can scarcely think of another statutory provision that has generated more uncertainty and more circuit splits, which is saying something. First, the question whether or not a person has to be a fiduciary to commit honest services fraud. The language of Skilling itself notes that the vast majority of honest service cases that predated McNally involved offenders who, quote, in violation of a fiduciary duty, participated in bribery or kickback schemes, unquote. And Justice Scalia's dissent described the right as, quote, the right not to have one's fiduciary accept bribes or kickbacks, unquote. Now, a slight majority of courts have said that there does have to be a fiduciary duty before honest services fraud will be found. That is the 3rd and 11th circuits, to a lesser extent the 6th circuit, and to an even lesser extent the 5th circuit. But three courts of appeals have said there is no need for a fiduciary duty, the 8th and the 2nd circuit, both of which predate Skilling, and the 9th circuit, which postdates Skilling. And ordinarily, you know, this is time for Ninth Circuit jokes. I'm as apt to make them as anybody, but the decision was written by Judge Kleinfeld, who I think is one of the better judges on the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit did hold, however, that although there is no need for a fiduciary duty, it said there, quote, must be a legally enforceable right to have another provide honest services, unquote. And I don't know, I must be missing, I can't appreciate the legal niceties, but that sounds, in some ways, that sounds like it has to be a fiduciary. I don't know what the difference is between having a legal obligation to give honest services and not being a fiduciary, because a fiduciary, after all, is a person who is required to act for the benefit of another person on all matters within the scope of their relationship. But that said, I think it is a good idea to unpack it, just because fiduciary is a term that is kind of freighted, and if you just talk about specifically what you're going for, you know, a duty to provide honest services, whatever, although that causes other problems, as we will find out shortly. Secondly, I think there is a lack of clarity about the relationship between the honesty and the services. The same Ninth Circuit decision, I think it is alone in this regard, added an additional requirement for honest services fraud, which was based on Judge Rina Raji's concurring opinion and the Second Circuit en banc in Rabicki, which is one of the most important, I think, pre-Skilling Court of Appeals decisions. And they said that the honest services statute only applies to, quote, deprivation of services the value of which depends on their being performed honestly, unquote. And this is my quote that is, you know, a real mind bender. A quote from the opinion, dishonest deprivation of services differs from deprivation of honesty in providing services. The statute criminalizes the latter, not the former, unquote. Now, that is a sentence that only a lawyer could write. I got to the end of the sentence. I've read the whole opinion. I didn't know which one he was going to say was prohibited. This all kind of boils down to the general impulse, which is that the example that Brian gave, that the guy who plays hooky in order to go to a baseball game shouldn't be committing a federal felony. Of course, after Skilling, there has to be bribery involved. So the example which the opinion said is not included is employee gets a ticket from a vendor, goes and plays hooky, and puts his suit coat on the chair and tells his coworkers to lie to the boss and say he's there. Now, that is not a problem. However, if under the Ninth Circuit's interpretation. However, if as a result of that he then starts giving that guy the business and, you know, buys office supplies from that person, then we have honest services fraud. Now, I am all for trying to read the statute to avoid things that are really pretty minor offenses and from federalizing those. But there's something very unsatisfying to me about this, about saying, leaving it to judges to decide which, you know, services you provide to an employer are, you know, require you to be honest and which don't. It kind of reminds me of the Casey Martin case and the Supreme Court telling the Professional Golf Association which rules are important enough that, you know, you can't make an exception for the handicap and which rules are sufficiently unimportant that you are required to make an exception. Because I think that there are a lot of people like, you know, my father, a very crusty old man, he thinks that if you lie to him, you're no good for anything. He doesn't want your help. And so I think there's something very unsatisfying about this. The third lack of clarity is in whether or not bribery requires a quid pro quo. Now, the Supreme Court said that the prohibition on bribes and kickbacks is given content not only by pre-McNally law. We all have to go back and look at those crusty old pre-McNally cases to figure out what bribery and kickbacks mean, but they're also given content by federal statutes that define similar offenses, and they gave three. 18 U.S.C. 201, which is the general bribery statute, or specifically 201B. The federal program bribery statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 666A2. And the Anti-Kickback Act, which is limited to federal contractors, which is 41 U.S.C. 522. And although I think the Supreme Court thought it was giving additional guidance when it cited Section 201 and Section 666, in some ways it made it more complicated. It added additional confusion because those statutes are worded differently and they've been interpreted differently. Section 201 prohibits giving something, quote, with intent to influence any official act, unquote, while Section 666 prohibits giving something, quote, with intent to influence or reward an agent, and that is in connection with any business. And it's very different to talk about influencing an act, which sounds more like quid pro quo, and influencing an agent, which I think at least arguably sounds more like something that prosecutors have been trying to accomplish for a while, which is making bribery out of basically just currying favor, where you're just, you know, trying to get in good. So, you know, here's a ball cap with our company's name on it, or, here's a silver shovel from our groundbreaking. And Section 201B has been interpreted as requiring a quid pro quo. The Supreme Court said so in dicta in the Sun Diamond Growers case. And as far as I know, every court of appeals has said there's a quid pro quo, although you kind of have to after the Supreme Court's dicta. Including a decision by Sotomayor on the Second Circuit, which was actually construing 1346, the honest services statute, but mentions 201 along the way and also 666. But Section 666, the courts are split about whether or not there is a quid pro quo requirement. It's actually the minority view. Only the Fourth Circuit has said there's a quid pro quo requirement, whereas the 6th, 7th, and 11th circuits have held there is no quid pro quo requirement. The 7th and 11th circuits, although the cases may be all over the map on this, there are certainly some of the cases which make it sound like all you have to do is influence the recipient. And between influencing and, you know, in connection with, which has been recognized as being pretty broad language, it could be, you know, significantly broader. Most of those cases, or virtually all of them, have been only in connection with 666, but there is one post-Skilling district court case which specifically says no quid pro quo requirement in connection with the honest services statute, citing the 11th Circuit's interpretation of Section 666. And if we wanted to have additional clarity on this matter anytime soon, we're out of luck. There were three cases that were on for Friday's Supreme Court conference raising this issue about whether or not you have quid pro quo in the 666 context, and they denied all of them. So we're going to have to wait a little bit longer. And this, I hasten to add, is just scratching the surface. This sort of three areas of confusion I've talked about is just scratching the surface. All of the splits which predated Skilling pretty much post-dated as well. The WAREC split, which is whether or not you have to have a duty under state law, courts are still split. Both the majority specifically noted that. Oddly, since that granted cert on the question, the majority in Skilling specifically noted that. Well, I think the Conrad Black split, which is whether or not you have to have intended to pry, that's the one, whether you have to intend the victim economic harm. And then the third split about whether or not you have to intended private benefit, which I think might be the Skilling split, but I'm not sure. Finally, just a quick word about kickbacks. The law is not nearly as confused about kickbacks, but the courts have generally resisted attempts to define what a kickback is narrowly. The district court in my city, the D.C., by a fairly influential an opinion by a fairly influential judge that I suspect will be influential, rejected attempts to limit fiduciary relationships that will be actionable as a kickback to those that were clearly established at the time of McNally, that is, politician, constituent, employer-employee, and union boss, union member, and said, no, if you got a fiduciary duty, you're on the hook. And so it doesn't seem like there's anybody carving away, but there at least doesn't seem to be the lack of clarity that there is with respect to other elements.
Thanks, John.
Ron.
So these gentlemen are clearly experts and intellects. I am a trial lawyer, which means that I am an expert in nothing and certainly have no intellect. So I won't try to tell you what the law is, but rather talk for a few minutes about what difference does it make? I mean, why was this important to the government to begin with? I think we can all agree. So you sort of know just from reading about Enron what Skilling's role was. And we heard a little bit about Weyrich and his role. I'll tell you just as brief as I can about the Hollinger case. What that was about was, you know, they had a newspaper enterprise. And Conrad Black saw that newspapers were going to fade as the internet grew. And so he started selling these newspapers. Well, Conrad Black to Canada is like Donald Trump in the United States. You know, he's a larger than life personality. So some of these sales agreements had within them agreements that not only would Hollinger International not compete, but Conrad Black would not compete. Sometimes that was inserted by Conrad Black for good or bad reasons left for the jury to decide. Sometimes the buyers actually asked for it. And Conrad Black and other supervisors took money for those non-compete payments, lots of money, millions and millions of dollars. Now, what these things have in common is, as a practical matter, when you hear about it, when you hear about Jeff Skilling, when you hear about Weyrich, although I will say that that case has always struck me as at the margins to begin with. But you know, when you hear about that, you don't want your legislatures soliciting job opportunities for people who you're going to vote on their bills. So even Weyrich, which is at the outside edge of that, you know, is, and certainly the Conrad Black example, you don't like it. It's something that you say, gee, these guys shouldn't be doing this. And that's the value of it in a criminal prosecution. Because it is always, in the civil context, the honest services fraud is always, almost without exception, coupled with a property fraud that the defendants took money, as it was in the Conrad Black case, as it was in the Skilling case, that they, you know, that they took money. But there's an honest services charge that even if you find that they didn't take money, they deprived their employers of their honest services, and in the public official case, deprived the public. It's sort of a backstop. And that has a lot of appeal. Because, for example, in the Conrad Black case, the wrinkle was that all of these, you know, and I'll oversimplify because there were debates about this, but all of these were all of the payments were disclosed to the audit committee, which has to approve these transactions, and at least in the proxy statements and 10-Ks and every other public filing, approved by the audit committee. So the jury had a real question, and I think rejected each of the property fraud counts. They said, well, you know, yeah, they took this money, but it was okay for them to take the money. But we don't think it's right. And they found them guilty on counts that probably, we'll never know, probably were based on the honest services count. That's why it's important. It's kind of a backstop for these prosecutions. Now it's gone, for the most part. Although lots of confusion, as has been said. But if you assume that the statute, the honest services fraud, has been cut back, that's why it makes a difference. I mean, we can all agree, for example, that Governor Blagojevich used his public office for personal uses, for personal benefit. Whether or not we agree that he took money, he used it for personal benefits. About that, there's very little room for debate. But the government is going to have to prove at his retrial that he actually took bribes, that they will attempt to prove that there was a quid pro quo. They will attempt to prove that there were, in fact, kickbacks. And they will not have the argument that, hey, look, even if you find that he did not take this money, that there was not a quid pro quo for this money, he did things that a governor shouldn't do. And that's a big difference between the law as it existed before Skilling, Weyrich, and Black, and after. There are other statutes that I think the government will turn to, particularly in the public sector, that sort of make that distinction a little less compelling. One is, for example, the extortion statute. And that says that if an official under a government official under color of official right gets property from another, then to which he or she is not entitled, then they have committed extortion under federal law. Well, that's pretty darn close, because if you have, say, a pronouncement that says to somebody, you know, I will vote for your legislation if you retain this contractor. Well, is that extortion? He has obtained property for someone to which he is not necessarily entitled under color of official right. That's very, very close to an honest services fraud. And may help to fill the gap in the public arena. In the private sector, the gap is being filled, as well as the public sector is being anticipated to be filled, by legislation. There are two bills currently in Congress, one in the Senate, one in the House, different, but both of them talk about the distinction that the government sought to make at oral argument in all of these cases, which is that an undisclosed conflict of interest, whether or not you had a fiduciary duty, an undisclosed conflict of interest from which you benefit is an honest services fraud. The Senate version includes a private sector prong to that. The House version does not. It is only the public. It's only the public sector. That would give the government virtually all of what it previously wanted, and would sort of return us to where we were. Those pieces of legislation, clearly, if the case law is vague, they do about as much as the fix for McNally, which is say, oh, gee, we meant that property meant honest services, to now say undisclosed conflict of interest is honest services doesn't advance the ball too far, but that's a potential fix.
Well, thanks to all three of you. I know I have a couple of questions, but I do first want to throw it open to the floor and solicit any questions from any of you. Yeah.
I have a comment and a question. As a private citizen, I'm less concerned with the Jeffrey Skinner's and Conrad Black's in the world. And I think about the Robin Bridge, it's all those things. Metaphorically, not really in person, obviously. But it seems to me that a Conrad Black, who parlance of one of the panels, took money, is doing nothing more than anyone else in the private sector. Negotiate a contract. If that is criminal behavior in and of itself, or what Skilling has done in and of itself, criminal behavior, then we have to be looking at every Wall Street banker and every bank who negotiates a really, really sweet deal at the expense of the shareholders, depositors, and folks. So it seems to me those are questions of shareholder democracy and the capitalist system at work. My question is, what remedies do citizens have in the absence of honest services statute against either corrupt or totally inept politicians who hold office, who do take money out of our pockets against our wills, ultimately backed by coerced loans, because we do not pay our taxes, and the black votes come to us. Former counterparts, prosecutors. So what recourse does an honest citizen and a taxpayer have against, say, a governor of a fictional state who either is engaged in bribery and corruption or his or her personal gain and furtherance of ambition, or is so totally disengaged and enough that that person has left the running of the job, running of the state, to friends and associates, perhaps even non-citizens who may be serving prison time on their own, just to take a hypothetical.
Well, I think that in the first case, if it is bribery and they're actually taking money, that's clearly, the Supreme Court has held, that is within the heartland of honest services.
Well, yeah.
You have bribery statutes and honest services remain. But let's take another case more of favoritism, so closer to the line, where a governor or the mayor of a fictitious city gives his buddies a no-bid contract for wrought iron fences across the city, and they make tens of millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money. What is the recourse for that? I will tell you my view, I think, consistent with when I was a prosecutor and when I was as a private citizen, we have an extremely powerful tool, and one the founding fathers envisioned us using, perhaps more intelligently than we do, the vote. We ought to be a lot more careful about who we elect, and we ought to vote them out of office. I mean, we knew that who Rod Blagojevich was, at the risk of sounding like Denny Green, he was exactly who we thought he was. We knew that. The U.S. Attorney's Office broke the George Ryan matter before the election. It didn't even register a ripple on the Richter scale. the citizenry has to get a lot more responsible about exercising their vote. That's the remedy for the for inept government, for, you know, cronyism that doesn't amount to it. I don't think, for my view, is you don't enforce good politics, good government in the criminal courts. You do it at the ballot box.
That is all very wonderful. We'd be fine with Scott. And we'd be better part of the last 7 years. This city has less democratic participation in government than Stalin's Russia did in terms of changing government. And everybody in this city is from Russia. So what do you do, putting on your old prosecutor's hat, without the with the circumscription of the armed services fraud statute now, in the favor trading area, which is, I think, what the gentleman was alluding to? You take care of me this time, I'll take care of you now.
Just to be clear, I distinctly heard him say that he was talking about a hypothetical state and a hypothetical city. If your question is, what do we do if the offender is a Democrat in Chicago, I think that's a whole different question.
Hey, look, Bill, it's difficult. But I still think, you know, the answer isn't favor trading. How are you going to enforce that in the federal criminal courts? So, for example, where's the line? How about the legislator who says, look, I don't agree with this bill, but I will vote for it if you vote for my bill? Trading favors, but that's as old as politics is.
Well, suppose you're trading favors in the property, you go with this insurance company this time, and the next time around, you send your business to my cousin who's got his own insurance company. I mean, the aldermen in the city have been making money for decades running insurance brokers, right?
Right.
And sitting on the boards of banks, law firms, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, actually, let me piggyback on that. Is there anything wrong with that, or is there a mechanism to pursue that? It's not so hypothetical. I know the case you're talking about. We were on opposite sides of it, which is mayor of ABC Village who steers business to an insurance company in which he has an interest, but he fails to disclose that interest. Is there any mechanism, federal, state, criminal, civil, that can pursue that?
Well, the mayor's brother is an insurance broker and makes millions, which is not a problem.
There are, you can try. You can try and fit that under extortion. I don't know that it works. I don't think it's a pat answer to say about our aldermen, the law is ridiculous. But the answer isn't to create a body of criminal law. The answer is change the law. I mean, that we don't participate in our democracy is shame on us. It's not for the U.S. Attorney's Office. We can't abdicate our responsibility as citizens and say, Bill, bail us out. I mean, that's just a bad system, I think.
Yeah. Joel.
I'd like to throw two real life situations together. Let's go back to the Kroner case. Kroner was accused of being given the opportunity to buy stock at a racetrack company of the exchange to approve racetrack bids. And I quit from both. Some people I thought I'd read from both. And Mark Heather, who was involved in the case, was acquitted of paying bribes. Where would the Kroner case come out today? That's situation one. Situation two, I'm a federal mayor, they will know who I'm talking about at Rome. Who tells his police department not to prosecute his nephew who may have committed a crime. And no prosecution occurs for many years until the newspapers pick up the story of the case is reopened. Has that mayor committed, under the current case law, a crime?
John or Brian, any thoughts on that?
I don't know the Kerner case well enough to comment on that. I'm working on the second question. When we were in, when My old firm, which was did a lot more white-collar stuff, we actually had a whole book of misdemeanors just so that we could always find something to plea our clients to. And so I'm sort of mentally
can I have that book?
Going through the U.S. code now to figure out a way to fit that, not into the to the misdemeanors, like, improperly using the image of Woodsy Owl, but into the felonies. I'm still working on that because I'm trying to think of if there's any sort of wrongdoing or just, malfeasance in office.
About obstruction of justice. Yeah. The Koerner case, I think, is pretty clearly under today's law outside the honest services. But that was a bright line. That's a bright line created by, as you point out, the acquittal on the bribery. But I think, I don't know, I'd have to pull out the statute book as well, but I think the second is obstruction of justice.
It's a lot clearer if it were a federal offense that they put on ICE and if it was a state offense. I don't know if the federal obstruction statutes apply to state offenses. Tampering with state witnesses, I think not.
Although part of this goes back to the point that the last gentleman's question raised, which is, so what's the right remedy? In both of those cases, it just sounds like it's a terrible idea and something ought to be done. But what is the something and who ought to be the doing? Is the answer reflectively to look to federal law to make it a felony and for the U.S. attorney to go after it? Have we really, to that level, given up on the ability of our elected officials here in Illinois to do anything?
Yes.
Oh, well, there you are.
Joel.
I suspect that you guys have spent, you three of you have spent as much time as anybody staring at those 28 words in 1346. Do any of you think, given the experience you have dealing with the statute, that there is a way to draft a general honest services statute using, say, 56 words or 100 words, rather than doing what the Supreme Court did in Skilling and cutting it back to crimes that already are defined in legislation and case law? Or is it just the notion of honest service is just too general, even with more words?
You know, I think the thing to do is to think about what exactly you want to get at and break it down that way. Like, although I made a little bit of fun of them, like the Ninth Circuit saying there has to be a duty under state law to, owe honest services, although they use the very same phrase. And I would just kind of break down what exactly you're going for. You know, ordinarily, statutes spell out what all the elements are right there. And one of the many problems with the honest services statutes is it's, kind of incorporated pre-existing law when the pre-existing law wasn't terribly clear. Pre-existing common law, too. I mean, it's essentially just kind of codified common law. So I think that first, Judge Edmondson on the 11th Circuit said we must never speak more clearly than we're thinking. And I think some of the problem with honest services statute is that you have an impulse of outrage, but you haven't really broken down what exactly is outrageous about it. And once you figure out what that is, I think you'd be in a better position to say what the elements of it are.
Andrew.
Two comments and sort of piggybacking off what they already said. In terms of the hypothetical that you raised, the failure of the prosecutor, the president, the mayor, I think in the federal context, and I think that might actually touch upon a fairly untested statute that I actually think would be highly litigated in the future, which is 18 U.S.C. 1519, which is the post-Sarbanes-Oxley statute, which is essentially the obstruction statute on steroids, and gives prosecutors a 20-year statute, and is much longer than the traditional obstruction statute. And I think it applies to agencies and departments of the federal government. So the U.S. Attorney's Office, for example, would fall within the ambit of that. And so if, the president or a senator said, do not prosecute my cousin or my brother or whatever the hypothetical is, I think it may very well fall into that 1519 realm. And then in terms of sort of the contracts or the insurance contracts or something else where business is not given to one insurer or there's a quid pro quo or a favor to them, I wonder how much litigation in the civil context or in the administrative context, bid protests and things like that, which are available and very much a part of the DC practice, at least in the federal government, where you constantly have protests to RFPs and RFQs and a lot of money that's made in it. I wonder how alive that might sort of become on the local level in at the state level and how alive it is already, as well as sort of the private right of action, or maybe just even sort of the ability to charge the civil law, say these are unfairly awarded contracts. And by the way, we're going to do a deposition of the government. And you know, we're going to ask some of these questions and send them down for a deposition. I don't know if those are available, if that's also sort of pie in the sky, but it seems that sometimes there's more than just no prosecution or no action versus, you know, criminal action. And you know, I think the civil regulatory framework offers an alternative as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, if you look at activity in state attorneys' general offices around the country, there's been a serious uptick across the board in consumer protection efforts and others. I wouldn't be surprised to see more action in that playing field as well.
I think there is something to doing it in that way, because, I mean, in that way, you also get potentially sort of the private market gets interested in that, you know, if it's there's a profit to be made, you're sure to get lawyers involved. The one thing I'll say, though, is that remember when they added the civil cause of action in RICO, because they thought that this would, you know, loose private forces against sort of the mob. And, you know, if any suit has ever been brought by a private citizen, it's, you know, the original targets of RICO, you know, everyone would drop over dead of shock. You know, it's been used basically for business torts ever since. So that's just the law of unintended consequences, which is, you know, present as much in criminal law as any place else in the world.
By the way, I think they'd be dead before they had the chance to die of natural causes.
That's true, too. Yeah, exactly.
Slight disincentive. John, I have a question for you. You noted the various fault lines in the cases, and one of them was this question of bribery and kickbacks. And in fact, now the law would seem to say that that's the heartland of cases. And so long as you have a traditional bribery or kickback, then you're fair game. But my question is, how clear is it really what a bribe and what a kickback is? I think you started to address that, but are we going to find ourselves, and are you in fact seeing reference to state definitions of what bribes and kickbacks are? And then are you going to have a multiplicity of options so that you're back in the world of confusion?
I think that's a very good point. I haven't seen it as much on the kickback side, but just reviewing cases for this presentation, I actually did see a case where they were referring to the state definition of bribery to determine whether or not a bribe had been given. And the state had a very idiosyncratic definition. I don't remember which state it was. It was like Georgia or something. But they based it on that, which is odd, because that's, you know, the one thing you can be almost sure that Congress did not have in mind when they were saying what a bribe is. But there's kind of a hydraulic pressure too, because a lot of times there is the impulse that something outrageous has been done and they're looking for a way to get at it. And so they will bring something as bribery, even if it is, you know, to use the phrase used by Kevin Ring's lawyers in a prosecution in D.C., which was bribery light or bribery-esque. And I've definitely seen it before. You know, I remember I was in the U.S. Attorney's office when they used the access device fraud statute, which I had always assumed they meant credit cards when they said access devices, and they used it for bus transfers. And I'm still not sure if that's a valid use of that statute. But there's kind of pressure that, you know, you think this is wrong and we got to get it. And then they prosecute it, and the district judge, you know, frequently they'll say, like, you know, this is what the Court of Appeals is for, you know, unless it's really bad, you know, I'll let it go. And then when it gets to the Court of Appeals, they're like, these guys are bad, you know, we better affirm if we can. And then it happens like this, and then, you know, 20 years later, finally the Supreme Court is like, you know, we ought to get around to, you know, addressing that law that was enacted, you know, 30 years ago. Finally says what it is and creates turmoil for a while. It seems like about every 5 years, the Supreme Court has another decision which throws the criminal law field into complete turmoil because they upend settled expectations. But, you know, it's a long way of saying that people will tend to press statutes as hard as they can. And so I think I would not be at all surprised that now that we're left with just bribery and kickback, if everything starts to look like bribery or kickback.
Yeah. Well, I think we've reached the witching hour. I want to thank everybody for coming, and a special thanks to our panel, and John, to you for traveling long distance for it. That was a great presentation. Thanks so much.